So the first time I heard anything like the ideas I'm going to discuss today was when I was a teenager reading science fiction, and I encountered this concept. So the laughter's coming from everyone who has read Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. People who haven't read it, I can tell you a little bit about the premise of this book, or one of the things which happens in this book. The idea is that there's another crystalline form of H2O, aside from the ice that we know, and it's denser, and a physicist would say, hence at lying at a lower energy equilibrium state than the ice that is familiar to us. And it has the annoying property that if you put it next to some water, it will, well, the way Vonnegut put it was, it would teach the water how to crystallize in this way. And immediately that water freezes into ice 9, which had a melting point of like 100 degrees or something like that, Fahrenheit, and caused the entire surface of the Earth to freeze when it was introduced. So I'm not telling science fiction today, but this notion, which is actually been made fairly precise in similar discussions in quantum field theory and in cosmology, that you could have a state which is at an equilibrium, namely the existence of water and ordinary ice as we're familiar with it on the surface of the Earth, and yet there could be some other equilibrium point which we're not aware of, but which could, the existence of which could mean that somehow we're going to, at some point after a triggering event, arrive at that other equilibrium point. And Vonnegut was really making that point quite nicely, maybe a little inaccurately, but never mind, quite nicely in his fictional account of Ice 9. So the title of the talk is Decay of False Vacua. And as I say, it's an old idea in both quantum field theory and cosmology. If you have a classical or quantum theory that has some kind of scalar field as part of the theory, and that scalar field has some potential associated to it, then we're familiar with the classical result that the value of the scalar field should be at the minimum of the potential. And in quantum mechanics, there will be some fluctuation, potentially, but the fluctuation tends to, for the most part, stay in the bottom of a potential well of that kind. However, if the potential has more than one minimum, then it's quite possible for the state of the physical system to be at this minimum, yet there to be more favorably, from the energetic point of view, minimum down there, which the system hasn't reached. Now, classically, you're kind of stuck here, right? You're stuck near the minimum point that you were originally given. Quantum mechanically, there can be these tunneling events in which, with some probability, you get through, or maybe more accurately, get over the potential barrier and end up with a state that's more like this. And any theory, such as the standard model for elementary particle physics, including a Higgs field, which has a scalar field in it that has a non-zero expectation value, is potentially subject to this kind of phenomenon. So this was discussed extensively in the physics literature. Actually, I'm not a good historian of this, but I'm aware of discussions that go back to early discussions of the Higgs mechanism, where it was realized that because there was a scalar field in the theory, there was a potential for some kind of decay from the value that we currently see to some lower value, which maybe would only be reached after crossing an appropriate potential barrier. In cosmology these days, a similar idea is important. So this field had some name. A similar idea is important where you have some scalar field associated to some potential. Now, my discussion a moment ago of the Higgs field was kind of ignoring the possible coupling to gravity, but in the cosmological case, one wants to consider cases which are coupled to gravity, and one imagines that it's some potential governing the behavior of some scalar field that's responsible for the inflationary era in cosmological history. And in fact, there are ways of making very precise connections. I'll mention one part of this story in just a minute. But there are ways of making very precise connections between the behavior of the potential for that scalar field and the way that the universe evolves during the period in which the potential, the expectation value of that field is going from a larger value down to a smaller value. That's what causes cosmological inflation. So here I was imagining a Higgs-type field with several minima. Here I'm imagining something like an inflation scenario, where it's the role of the scalar field down the hill which causes the cosmological phenomenon of inflation. The situation I want to focus on today is actually a situation that's even a little more unusual. And that's a case where you have a theory that has an inverted potential, a field with an inverted potential. Now, the coefficient of the quadratic term near a minimum is supposed to tell you the mass squared of the particle. That's a general phenomenon if you're using a kind of lowest order term approximation to the description of the physical system. Here that coefficient is negative, and so when you see such a field, it looks like it ought to be a tachyon. It's got a negative mass squared instead of a positive mass squared. But physically, of course, what this really means is that you're sitting at some equilibrium which is not stable. The slightest perturbation of the physical system of any kind is going to cause that potential to roll. And, excuse me, let me make things a little better. It's going to cause it to the value to roll, and presumably it rolls down to another minimum and achieves a more stable equilibrium point. Or if you're unlucky, maybe there's a roller coaster type effect and you have to do that a few times. So people have talked about possibly thinking about the beginning of the inflationary period as coming from something up on top of a hill of that sort. So it may be related to the first kind. And model of what's happening here during the condensation ought to be related to the model of what's happening during this time period between the tunneling event and reaching a new equilibrium point here. So any study that can shed light on these is going to, on this problem in particular, is going to have something potential to say about the other problems as well. So I'm going to look at a particular kind of tachyon condensation, it's called. And this is tachyon condensation from closed string theory. If you don't know the difference between open and closed string theory, never mind. In string theory, of course, we're in a really interesting situation. The string models that are self-consistent as theories of physics are 10-dimensional models. So we require a 10-dimensional space-time to have a sensible supersymmetric string theory, superstring theory. But typically, one thinks of that 10-dimensional space-time as consisting of a compact 6-dimensional piece together with ordinary Minkowski space in 4 dimensions. Maybe it's not quite a product structure. Maybe there's some variation in the compact 6-manifold as you move around in Minkowski space. But that's the basic model. I'm going to spend a few minutes discussing how it is we can learn something about physics in 4 dimensions by a careful study of these compact 6-dimensional spaces. And then I'll mention what features of the compact 6-dimensional spaces could lead to some tachyons in the spectrum of the string theory. And that will let me apply some geometric techniques to study this process of tachyon condensation. So these particular models that I'm going to talk about were pioneered by Adams, Polchinski, and Strominger. Silverstein, excuse me. My mind was on the fact that there was somebody from Santa Barbara involved, but yes, of course. Adams, Polchinski, and Silverstein. And there's been a lot of follow-up work, including particular work in general relativity aspects of these models by Gary Horowitz. So it's maybe dangerous to give a colloquium about stuff that was done by the people in the audience, but that's what I'm doing. So the first thing to understand is why the translation into geometry. So I was trained as an algebraic geometer. I had an early amateur's interest in particle physics, I have to say. I mean, as a teenager, not only did I learn about Einstein, but I learned about the Eightfold Way of Murray Gell-Mann, and I knew the difference between science and science fiction. It was actually a very interesting time to be growing up in science, to watch the development of particle physics from an amateur's perspective in the late 60s and early 70s. That said, I was trained as a mathematician and only really was able to use the skills that I have in the particular field of mathematics known as algebraic geometry after some very fundamental work by some other people establishing the dictionary, which I now want to review for you a little bit so that you can see how I'll be able to address some of the details of the behavior under tachyon condensation. So the simplest picture that one likes to draw is the picture of a garden hose viewed from a distance of 100 yards. If you have a garden hose viewed from a distance of 100 yards, it's hard to notice the compact direction of the garden hose. You notice something has a lot of length, a certain extent to it, but you don't notice that there's this compact piece. And that's the basic idea for describing an effective four-dimensional theory of physics out of this 10-dimensional space-time, which has a rather small six-dimensional compact part. Now, when you try to do this kind of description of the four-dimensional physics, it's natural to take a 10-dimensional field in the theory and to somehow expand that 10-dimensional field according to harmonics of the six-dimensional field. So let me just put some arbitrary index there. So if I were just looking at functions, I could take coefficients like this times, let me write the coefficient like this times some basis for the harmonics on the six manifold. So the EI6 are, say, harmonic functions on Y6. And typically, so if it's the circle, it's not so hard to figure out what the harmonic functions are. If it also, maybe for two-sphere, we've all learned in elementary physics or mathematics courses something about the harmonics, the spherical harmonics in two dimensions. They get a little more complicated than they were in one dimension, but they're still sort of accessible. But in general, compact spaces, any compact space that I'll use as Y6 has potentially some harmonic functions, and I can try to do an expansion like this of a 10-dimensional function. I can also do it for other quantities. Gauge fields and so on can be expanded in terms of appropriate harmonic objects. Now, when you evaluate an expansion like this in the quantum field theoretic action that's used to govern the, say, the world sheet formulation of the string theory, or if you use it in action that's governing general relativity on that spacetime, you discover that the dominant contributions come from the lowest lying modes and that the higher harmonic functions contribute less and less as you go on. So it's not a bad approximation to take the lowest harmonic mode or perhaps the lowest few harmonic modes and to just sort of truncate to that particular sector of the theory to describe the entire theory. So in that way, behavior of certain kinds of functions, namely the harmonic spectrum, the way I'm describing it now, on that compact six manifold, provide the building blocks that we need to rewrite the 10-dimensional theory as a 4-dimensional theory. Namely, those harmonic functions are coming in here. Of course, we also need to know something about the coefficients, but that comes out in a detailed analysis of the theory. So, harmonic functions and forms on Y6 are the basic building blocks. Now, you may ask, if what I'm really interested in is just tachyon decay, why don't I simply take any potential function like that and solve some differential equation which explains what happens when the tachyon decays? And I could do that, but there's much too much flexibility. It's hard to learn any lessons about the answers. What this particular class of models does is it constrains us in various ways, and the more symmetry we impose on the compactified superstring theory, the greater the constraints will be. It constrains us in certain ways so that the physical phenomenon that we're modeling, such as the tachyon condensation of today, is not completely arbitrary, but really has some of its significant features dictated by the possible structures that could occur on these six manifolds, which are governing the transition from 10 dimensions to, down to 4 dimensions. So there are some things which we've learned by studying this kind of compactification over the years. One is that, not low energy, but supersymmetry in the effective theory corresponds to a geometric property of Y6. Now, I haven't been too precise so far about what I'm actually doing. At the very least, I'm taking a supergravity theory on the 10 manifold. And so for that purpose, I would need a metric on the 6 manifold, which is specifying the gravity theory. So when I talk about a geometric property of Y6, I mean Y6 equipped with its metric. And that geometric property has a name. It requires what's called a Kähler metric. So immediately by assuming that there is some kind of symmetry in the four-dimensional theory, you discover interesting ways in which symmetry properties are encoded. By the way, there is a generalization of this which has been studied a lot recently. A case in which the four-dimensional theory, well, let me say the four-dimensional Lagrangian is supersymmetric, but the vacuum is not. That's a case which may well be related to the real world. We know that at the lowest energies that we see in the laboratory, there is not supersymmetry in four dimensions. It's still quite possible, however, that there is some kind of broken supersymmetry, which is restored at higher energies, or which at least gives us a four-dimensional supersymmetric Lagrangian. And in that case, we get another geometric property, a slight weakening of this, which has the really descriptive name of generalized Kähler metric. Anyway, those haven't been studied in a lot of detail until recently, but in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of progress on that. I'm going to restrict, for the most part, to cases where the supersymmetric, I'm interested in cases where supersymmetry is broken. In fact, this kind of tachyon condensation typically breaks the supersymmetry in these theories. So I'll be working with manifolds which Yes. Yeah, that's what I've just confused in my simple discussion. So there's another condition on a geometric condition, which is that the metric should be Ricci flat, and Ricci flat metrics correspond to So what I just messed up was the Kähler condition corresponds to world sheet supersymmetry, and you need also Ricci flat and Kähler to get space-time supersymmetry. I was attempting to avoid having to describe what the difference between those two was, which led me astray. The second line is actually a generalization of this in a way. There, Ricci flat is not the right condition that you want, but these this work of Hitchin and collaborators in the last couple of years, studying both these generalized Kähler structures that give broken world sheet supersymmetry as well as space-time supersymmetry, kind of gives the right concept. Yeah, sorry. So there's a distinction here. One of the things that I'm doing is taking a supergravity theory, and if I'm just taking a supergravity theory, then I want to restrict to a special geometric property of the six dimensions, the six-dimensional metric, which is called Ricci flat Kähler. But if I were asking for the weaker condition of only world sheet supersymmetry, so what does that mean? This is a discussion of string theory, and so in addition to the supergravity theory, I should also attempt to describe the physics of a string propagating in that spacetime, and that in itself gives me a quantum field theory which lives on the world sheets that are swept out by the string. So it's world sheet supersymmetry which requires the metric be Kähler. Well, Ricci flat Kähler metrics on compact spaces, they are called these days Calabi-Yau manifolds or Calabi-Yau metrics on such manifolds because of work of Calabi and Yau. And there's a remarkable fact about them, which is that any such manifold, any such six manifold, and I guess I should put in the caveat with minimal supersymmetry, can be realized geometrically, this six manifold, as a submanifold of a very particular space called complex projective space. Moreover, so I'll say in 2 seconds what complex projective space is. Moreover, Y6 is defined by a collection of polynomial equations on this complex projective space. So we went from a rather hard problem, which was to understand specific metrics subject to a constraint like this, Ricci flat Kähler, but specific metrics on six manifolds, and a related hard problem, which I'm going to get back to shortly, of looking at harmonic functions and harmonic differential forms on such a six manifold, to a much different kind of geometric problem, describing six manifolds which can be defined by collections of polynomial equations in complex projective space. Yes? There's no bound on N. Well, there's no known bound on N. It's not known if they're finite in many Calabi manifolds. By some? It's an open question whether there are finitely many. Even if there were finitely many, I would have an infinite number of different embeddings into different complex projective spaces. So if there are only finitely many, and if I take the sort of lowest embedding of each of them, then maybe I can take a bound on it. So what's complex projective space? Complex projective space, you get pretty easily, you take n plus 1 tuples of complex numbers, and then you mod out by saying that any such n tuple is the same as a scalar times that n tuple. So this is minus the origin. And so it's polynomials in those variables v that I'm discussing, and I'll need typically a collection of polynomial equations in order to realize the six manifold, and it has to satisfy a particular technical property called trivial canonical bundle. So it's actually a tricky problem in this other field of geometry, algebraic geometry, to decide which of these manifolds sitting inside complex projective space has satisfied this condition, but it's a problem which, at least given a six manifold sitting inside complex projective space, you can always decide whether it is one of these or not, which is a sort of more concrete problem than the original one of trying to figure out what all the possible six manifolds might be. So now we're in the realm of algebraic geometry. And it's because of this dictionary, I meant to put the name dictionary, the names, so there are theorems of Calabi and Yao. Calabi having done his work in the late 50s, and Yao having completed the story in the mid 70s. Which give this dictionary between Ricci flat Kähler metrics and this particular class of what are called complex projective varieties. No. So this part of the story, the number six is even, that's important, but aside from the fact that it's even, there's no special role played by the number six. It was the kind of warm-up where I connected to string theory that six was important. Yeah, it has to be projective because H10 and H20 vanish. So all of H2 is type 1-1. So immediately any class in type 1-1, the Kähler class in particular, has to be integral, so it's a Hodge class. So that's why they're projective. So and that's why my comment about minimal supersymmetry. So cases like a product of a K3 surface and an elliptic curve, which has extra supersymmetry, doesn't have to be projective. This is what we like to do as mathematicians, by the way. We take a simple problem and we transform it into something else. Right, and then we solve the other one, and then we go back and see whether that tells us something about the simple one. So I started out with a problem where I was going to tell you about decay of false vacua by tachyon condensation, and I'm in the middle of this long translation, and now I'm going to tell you some things from algebraic geometry, and then I'll apply that back to the tachyon condensation problem before the end of the talk. Okay, so what do I want to tell you about algebraic geometry? Well, I want to tell you a story about what's called blowing up in algebraic geometry, blowing up and down. And to kind of make this concrete, I want to imagine doing the following thing. So let's take a two-sphere, and let's construct the two-sphere by gluing the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere along the equator. So this is S2 plus, this is S2 minus, and there's a common S1 where I'm going to glue. One remark which I meant to make earlier than this, but forgot, was that questions such as what are the harmonic functions, or at least qualitative questions about the harmonic functions, such as how many of them are there, can be answered about the six manifold rather simply. They can be answered in terms of crude geometric properties, those known as topological properties, and those topological properties can be inferred from the description in terms of algebraic geometry. So we really are making progress toward the goal. Now I'm going to tell you about some other kinds of topological things. So I'll build my two-sphere by gluing two hemispheres along the equator. And what I want to do is explain how to make circle bundles, so S1 bundles, over S2. So what do I mean by that? Well, I take a field of circles varying over the upper hemisphere. There isn't really too much you can do topologically. It just looks like the upper hemisphere crossed the circle. And along the equator, I've got this field of circles along the equator. Along the equator, I've got S1 cross S1. And then I've got the lower hemisphere, field of circles, S2 minus cross S1. But when I do the gluing, there's now something interesting that I can do. As I'm identifying the family of S1s that move around the circle from the northern hemisphere with the one from the southern hemisphere, I can imagine doing a twist in the fiber circle as I run around the identifying circle. So you can do a twist by capital N, and you produce a three-manifold. And you get a different three-manifold depending on which values of N you use. So it's a little hard to visualize this kind of twisting. So in the case of N equal 1, we'll end up with a three-sphere. So now I'm going to ask you to do the mental exercise to take a three-sphere. It's a little hard to do, but just take the entire R3 that surrounds you and complete it at infinity. And now we're going to remove from that three sphere. Well, I'm doing an identification along S1 cross S1. So I take a torus, not a solid torus, but just a torus, right, the shape of a torus, and I remove it from the three sphere. And now I get, a lower and an upper hemisphere. In other words, I get two disconnected pieces. I get the inside of the torus and I get the outside of the torus, right? So what does the inside of the torus look like? It looks like a solid torus. Solid torus has the same shape as this guy did. It has the circle direction and it has the disc direction, the upper hemisphere direction, which is the slice of that solid torus. And I've glued it to, believe it or not, another solid torus. So the outside of a torus, if you include the point at infinity, is another solid torus. If you don't know that picture, so here's a torus. You have this family of smaller tori inside, right? But you can also take a family of increasing tori outside, which increase more and more and head toward the final circle, which is going all the way up to the point at infinity. So that's why the exterior is also a solid torus. So each of these things, the upper and the lower part, were solid tori, and I glued them together along that torus. And In fact, when you think about that gluing, there had to be a twist, an n equal 1 twist. If n is bigger than 1, I end up with S3 mod a finite group, a cyclic group of order n. So, well, I won't try to lead you through that mental exercise here, but that's what happens. So I now want to repeat the construction I had a moment ago, where I was taking circles over the two-sphere, but now I want to take those circles and take a cone over each of those circles. So I want to take, if you like, a family of circles of varying radius shrinking down to zero size and end up with a family of R2s over this S2. And what'll I get? Well, I've just done essentially a cone construction, so it will produce the cone over S3 mod Zn, and that looks like R4 mod Zn. Cone over S3 is an R4, and in fact I've just got R4 mod Zn. So if n equals 1, it's non-singular. And if n is greater than 1, it's singular. Well, rather than take the family of, when I took the family of R, I said this slightly wrong. When I took the family of R2s over S2, I got something over S2, right? So I got what's called a vector bundle, a real vector bundle of rank 4 over S2, and that maps to this cone, I should have said. It's not actually equal to the cone. So how do I imagine recovering the cone? Well, at the origin of the R2, I have the entire S2, and if I were to shrink that S2 down to zero size, then I would end up with the cone over S3 mod Zn. So there's this picture of a space, a four-dimensional space, which has an S2 kind of sitting in it. And the S2 has a size. And when we shrink the S2 to zero, we end up with this other space, R4 mod Zn. OK, so I want to explain several things about this. First of all, everything in sight respected a complex structure. And so I really have C2 mod Zn instead of R4 mod Zn. I really just told you a topological story, so that's not really adding any information. That story fits in as part of these Calabi-Yau manifolds, but 4 manifolds rather than 6 manifolds. So this is kind of a baby case of the one that I'm eventually going to be interested in. And this process of shrinking when n equals 1, in the n equal 1 case, what it says, if I kind of reverse the process, is that I can pick a point on a 4 manifold, in this case a complex manifold of complex dimension 2, and I can replace that point by, well, in some family parameterized by T, kind of reversing that process, I can replace it by a growing 2-sphere. So I didn't do anything to my space other than remove the point and put in a 2-sphere, and I'm allowed to give that 2-sphere any size that I like. I didn't mention sizes here, but the shrinking can be actually governed by some metric on the space. That's hard to draw, so let me draw you an analog of somewhat lower dimension. If I took a 2-manifold, this was a 4-manifold, now I'm going to take a 2-manifold, and I could replace the point by an S1 in this case. So that would just be puncturing the 2-manifold, leaving me with a 2-manifold with boundary, and I would be allowed to grow that aperture to whatever size I like. This is exactly the same process, but if you do it with complex variables instead of real variables, you discover that rather than having a boundary there, you have a space that is compact in a neighborhood like that and actually has the structure that I mentioned before of a family of R2s over S2. So this process is known as blowing up. Well, it's blowing up to create the two-sphere. It's blowing down to get rid of the two-sphere. So there are two facts from algebraic geometry that are relevant to my tachyon condensation story. The first fact is if a complex if a four-manifold with complex structure, which is what we've been dealing with here, contains an S2, which locally has a neighborhood like the n equal 1 case above, then the S2 can be contracted. And this can be applied to different S2s in sequence. So you can have a whole sort of configuration of two spheres maybe meeting each other, and there's an easy way to formulate when you'll be able to contract them down to a point, can be contracted to a smooth point. The contraction can be done using varying sizes of two spheres, as I've done here. But the second procedure, which kind of works in reverse, is any singular four-dimensional space, complex space, of complex dimension 2 can be blown up with the singular points being replaced by surfaces. So that's basically what was happening when n was bigger than 1 over here. When n was bigger than 1, the space downstairs was singular, and now I'm blowing it up. This is an example of number 2. Number 2 is a much more general statement that when you have a complex space with a complex analytic singularity, that there is a way to blow it up, replacing the singular point with surface. So now I want to go back to my picture. The picture is going to be a four-manifold and six-dimensional Minkowski space for just a second. Not the problem that I really want to solve, but that's only going to get the last 2 minutes of the talk, the way things are going. Unless this lasts longer than an hour, Tony. How long does it last? Or Mark? Okay. That was a very good answer to a very different question. So here I am back in my situation, and I want to ask, when is there a tachyon? And how does it condense? Well, it turns out that looking at surfaces, sigma, sitting in Y4, these correspond in some natural way to fields in the effective theory. And when sigma is a two-sphere, then the field is tachyonic if n is bigger than 2. Massless if n is equal to 2, and massive if n is equal to 1. For knowledgeable people in the audience, I will explain that I am being a little ambiguous about the orientation of the two-sphere, and in particular about the sign of n. So I'm kind of treating n as if it were always positive, which isn't quite right. The normal bundles that I'm looking at are actually negative normal bundles, not positive ones. So what do we expect to happen as the theory evolves? So under tachyon decay, well, under evolution of this theory, if I saw a two-sphere with n greater than 2, so it is. So what I didn't explain very clearly was that a small neighborhood of this two-sphere always looks like one of these twisted guys, right? And so the n measures the amount of twisting. So under evolution, when n is equal to 1, we see that there was a sphere, but that sphere does the blowdown thing. It shrinks in size, and it shrinks back to the point that it really ought to have been to begin with. If n equals 2, it's a regular non-singular point. In the case n equal 2, it just kind of sits there. Nothing happens. Yeah, I didn't really say. If I have to say, then a bunch of stuff that I swept under the rug, and in particular, what we're actually doing here is making what's called a world sheet model for this string compactification. And the evolution that I'm looking at specifically to get a result like this is renormalization group flow on that world sheet model, which is then being identified with the actual tachyon condensation process. If n equals 2, the sphere stays finite, and if n is bigger than 2, the sphere grows. So this geometric result from algebraic geometry turns out to have a nice translation into the behavior. When you see a tachyon, and this is a rough picture which had been speculated in lots of contexts. When you see a tachyon, let's see. So what I imagine is that the Minkowski space part of this guy has a value of the tachyonic field which initially starts out as zero and then someplace localized on the in the Minkowski space, it gets a little bit of a value. So drawing the fiber direction, at this place where it got a little bit of a value, all of a sudden, I get a little bit of this two-sphere popping up. So over here, where it's zero, I still have the singular point, right? So somehow there's a singular point in the space Y. But here, that singular point pops up into a two-sphere. And once it pops up into a two-sphere, it starts growing. And the dynamics is apparently this, that in space-time, the region in which you see that sphere gets bigger and bigger and bigger as time goes on. And in fact, the value of the tachyonic field sort of keeps increasing, and in the fiber direction, you get these big two spheres. So here's a big two sphere, near it is a smaller one. So you have a family of varying metrics in the compact direction, which is kind of reflecting this varying value of the tachyon field. And because it's a tachyonic field, this is all happening faster than the speed of light. It's causing an inflation in the effective space-time theory, and the mechanism by which that inflation happens is the sphere growing to overtake everything else in sight about that four-manifold. So although you started out with a four-manifold that had singularities, a four-dimensional space that had singularities, in fact, now this sphere is, and this sphere's neighborhood is really taking over the entire structure of the four-manifold. So since I'm dealing with closed string theories here, it's been recognized for a long time, more precisely since 1995, that these closed string theories also have other components called D-brains, and I'm talking about a D-brain which is wrapping this sigma that contributes to the effective theory. Okay, so the story of blowing up and blowing down, which is known as birational geometry in dimension 2, maps rather precisely to differing behaviors under renormalization group evolution or tachyon condensation of the a model like this, Y4 cross M6. So in the last minutes, however many of them there may be, the last I didn't say how many there would be, just the last minutes. Okay. So in complex dimension 2, namely the four manifolds I was discussing, the situation with blowing up and blowing down is very well behaved. You have a given manifold, which is a non-singular manifold, a specific sequence of these blowing down maps to a kind of minimal one. If there are variations in order of blowing down that are permissible, those variations commute with each other so that there's some common collection of sigmas which all get contracted to appropriate smooth points down in the space Y3. That's what happens in the blowing down. In the blowing up, if you start with a singular space, then again you can take the minimal blow up. That minimal blow up is unique, and it's obtained from any other blow up by these blow down procedures. So the situation with respect to figuring out which space something is going to head to, from this point of view of distinguishing between the n bigger than 2 modes, which are blow-ups of singular points, the n equal 2, which are blow-ups of a specific kind of singular point. By the way, the n equal 2 case is distinguished by the blow-up of the singularity being locally Calabi-Yau, and the n equal 1 case, which is the non-singular case, that sort of maps very nicely over to here. In complex dimension 3, however, the story of birational geometry is much more complicated. When you're trying to blow down, you can't always do the blow down directly. Sometimes you have to do an operation which is known as a flip, in which the space is modified by removing a two-sphere and gluing it back in some other way, but otherwise not changing the space too much. So there may be these flips. Moreover, there's no such thing as a unique minimal answer there can be a number of answers which are locally minimal. And so if you have a singularity and are trying to do a blow up of a singularity, there's no minimal blow up. Or maybe better, there are many minimal blow ups. So the question which Narayan Plesser and I asked was, how do we map this complicated situation in algebraic geometry, birational geometry in dimension 3, into this rather simple story of what the tachyon decay is going to be like. And although we don't have a general answer, we were able to address it in this same special case that Adams, Polchinski, and Silverstein started, namely, I should use a different letter, namely quotients of C3. So I'm going to start with a six manifold that looks like that. I'm going to look for tachyons in the spectrum. And as before, tachyons in the spectrum correspond to certain blow-up modes in the geometry. And the question that we asked was, what grows, what shrinks, what realizes these things called flips, and so on. And the basic picture, which I'll just give you a sketch of, is that when there's more than one tachyon in the spectrum, the initial tachyonic value can affect the flow in significant ways. So let me draw it like this. Here is a two-sphere sitting inside an R3 of tachyonic values. So I'm assuming a particular value for the given tachyonic field. So I start with some initial value, and the theory flows in some way, and it flows typically towards some particular point which corresponds to one of the minimal blow-ups. So as it does this flow, during the flow, some parts grow, some subspaces grow, as an analogy with the sphere growing there, and other ones shrink. In fact, if you tune the initial value, you can find fixed points in this kind of flow diagram, which correspond to various partial resolutions, various of the possible non-minimal blow-ups that occurred there. And if you take a general value, then the flow diagram has this property of kind of heading towards one of these intermediate points and then flowing off towards the final point. So I don't really have time to do this in detail, just giving you the kind of schematic picture that the complication of blowing up and blowing down, what's known as birational geometry in complex dimension 3, is reflected in the complication of what happens to the space. But in the end of the day, the space has the same basic phenomenon. Depending on the initial values, there are sigmas, and exactly which sigmas you get may depend on the initial values, which grow in size, and they grow to overwhelm the entire space. Yes? Right. So what I'm actually imagining doing is a refinement of the blowing up and down that algebraic geometers do, which also involves a choice of Kähler metric on the space, which measures the size of the exceptional set. So it's that family of Kähler metrics that realizes this continuous family of blowups that I'm discussing. So what can happen is different subspaces of the original space end up dominating depending on which of the initial values you take, and there are actually regions in the tachyonic expectation value space which determine which of the phenomena you're going to see, but something grows to overwhelm the space in all of these cases. Okay, so the basic picture of in space-time non-zero tachyonic expectation values starting out with its influence in a small direction and getting larger is something which is at least consistent with the story that I'm giving here. I haven't given any metric details, but that's, I guess, what Gary and Eva have been working on recently, of how that works. In fact, maybe I'll advertise Gary's talk tomorrow, which may be related to this. Maybe not, I don't know. This picture of the tachyon condensation, kind of as ICE 9 did, starting with an initial seeding of the tachyon condensation growing to overwhelm the space, that happens even in complicated geometric cases like that. So I think I'll stop there. Well, birational geometry in dimension past 3 is very challenging. So dimension 3 was the achievement of Reed, Morey, and co-workers in the 80s. And dimension 4, there's recent progress by somebody who was in the back row but has left. Oh, well. James McKernan, who's in the UCSB math department, has actually been studying this question of flips in higher dimension. But there are no general results of the kind that we have at our disposal in dimensions 2 and 3. There are precise conjectures about what the birational geometry should be in any dimension, but there aren't proofs. There aren't any significantly new phenomena beyond what I've described for you. Yes? Complex, that's right. Right. So if I'm looking at states in the theory which preserve some amount of world sheet supersymmetry, then I end up with these wrapped frames. So there's a symmetry assumption which is underlying this entire analysis, and implies that it's a complex subvariety. Yeah. Right. So I was implicitly doing type 2A string theory here, and you could try to do a similar sort of thing in type 2B string theory, but then we don't have the techniques of algebraic geometry at our disposal, so that's why I didn't do it.
So you say that some stuff can grow and some string can grow.
Yeah.
Does that mean you think of all four singularities?
Well, they shrink for a while, and then they stop shrinking.
Oh.
Right. You can fine tune it so that it goes there. But if you take a generic value, then it's there may be some shrinking for a while, but then everything is going to grow eventually. If it's singular, it has only n equal 2 type singularities. No. I mean, those were the ones at the stage of finite size. So right. Yeah. How about it? Yeah. Yeah. G2 is a one. Those are wonderful manifolds, but I don't know anything about them at this level of detail.
Well, thank you. Yeah.